Hi there. My name's Peter Cole. I'm a professor of history at Western Illinois University in Macomb, Illinois. I'm also the author and editor of several books on the industrial workers of the world, including Wobblies on the Waterfront, and most recently, Ben Fletcher, The Life and Times of a Black Wobbly, which was published by PM Press in 2021.
Awesome, and we encourage people to check out Peter's other appearances on this podcast. We'll, of course, link those in the show notes, but always good to have you back. We're going to be speaking today on something we haven't really talked about in the past. It's the Red Scare, or the one we're specifically talking about because there were several, but the Red Scare that occurred in the late 1910s into the early 20s. This correlated, of course, with the Russian Revolution happening in Russia. And we're going to be talking about how that played out, how it impacted specifically the IWW, but also the broader revolutionary left, anarchists, communists, socialists, and the general labor movement itself. And also just kind of how this correlates to the repression that's going on in Atlanta. And in general, just the state's attack on anarchists and other revolutionary movements today, because there are so many correlations I feel like we can make between what happened then and what's happening now. But just to start off, let's just start off by defining the Red Scare generally. What was it, and when did it occur? What are we talking about here, essentially?
Yeah, so red traditionally is associated with the color of the left, even though in the United States, unfortunately, due to network TV in the 90s, I think that now we associate red with the Republican Party and blue with the Democratic Party. But red, of course, is the color of the communist flag, as in the Soviet Union and in Vietnam and China and other places, right? Fear of reds, fear of communists, but more broadly, fear of anti-capitalists. Or socialists. And really, sort of anti-left repression goes back well into the 19th century, most importantly in 1886 with the Haymarket affair in Chicago. And then in the early 20th century, when really the first peoples who were specifically named for their beliefs to be excluded from the United States of America, anarchists, right? So, but in the World War I era, really is when the first so-called Red Scare emerges in the United States. So the European countries started to kill each other in 1914. The United States got involved in the war in 1917. And in 1917, really, you could start the first Red Scare in the United States because it was right after the U.S. had declared war in the spring of 1917 that the U.S. Congress also passed something called the Espionage Act, which I know we can talk about later, which basically empowers legally the U.S. Department of Justice to start going after radicals as defined by the United States government. And the number one target of the first Red Scare was the industrial workers of the world, because it was the largest, most influential revolutionary labor union in the United States and arguably the world at that time, right? And so the Red Scare then proceeded to essentially using government power, right, police power and courts to sort of attack the IWW and many of its members, leaders, and rank and file. And that then sort of spread to sort of going after other anti-capitalists, including those who were sympathetic to the Soviet Union. That included people who later would be called communists as well as anarchists, right, as well as radical immigrants. So from approximately 1917 into the 1922, about the government arrested thousands of Americans and immigrants, deported thousands, radically undermined the industrial workers of the world and other organizations, and basically was the blueprint for the so-called second Red Scare, which is what more people are familiar with, which was the post-World War II persecution specifically of the Communist Party, but also other leftists, from the mid 40s into the 60s. Yeah. And so, that's what we think of as the Red Scare, basically fear of the left, specifically government prosecution and persecution of the left, its organizations and individuals, supported often by the state and local governments, supported often by corporations. And in the case of the first Red Scare, supported by the American Federation of Labor.
Yeah, there's so many interesting parallels. I mean, I think the other one you brought up is the fact that this is taking place, obviously, as the United States enters World War One. And today, of course, you know, the United States is involved in numerous armed conflicts. And we're going to talk about how that kind of connects as well. But before we kind of jump into the history, let's talk a little bit about where the IWW was at as an organization at the time. This again is, you know, the period around 1917 when this history begins. And what else is happening inside the United States in terms of class struggle and the labor movement? Just paint a picture for us about what's going on.
Of course. So it's a very exciting time, actually, in the labor movement in some of the ways, some of the most interesting. So the Industrial Workers of the World was founded in 1905 in Chicago as a critique of the existing labor movement as represented by unions in the American Federation of Labor, which was seen as too narrow in its goals, not radical enough, not anti-capitalist, but also sort of intentionally choosing to not organize most women workers, most immigrant workers, most workers of color, right? And so the IWW was founded as a radical alternative in 1905. It grew rapidly in the second half of the aughts and then in the 19-teens and really sort of took off in the mid-19-teens. The IWW will spread to dozens of countries, although it was founded in and sort of largest in the United States. By the 19-teens in the sort of World War I era, 1914 through 18, the IWW had started to organize successfully in multiple industries in multiple parts of the country, in the Northeast, with textile workers and other factory workers in sort of industrial cities who were predominantly immigrants and the children of immigrants. Of course, I have written a lot about the IWW success in organizing a multiracial workforce on the Philadelphia waterfront and the third biggest city in the country. And the IWW was very successful then in the 19-teens in organizing migratory farm workers, who at that time were predominantly European and European-American men, but also some people of color, organized miners in, say, copper especially, but other sort of Rocky Mountain metals, organized farm workers in California, organized sailors, right, organized timber workers, especially in the Pacific Northwest, right? And so the IWW had managed to organize some workers in a number of really important industries, transportation, especially shipping, agriculture, mining, copper being the single most important metal for industrial economies, copper wiring, right? And so the IWW was growing. Its membership is sort of varies, but let's put it in the late 19-teens in the range of 100,000 workers. And that union is committed to revolution and class struggle, right? It's sort of ground into its very being, right? Now the non-AWW labor movement is also growing in the World War I era, and really sort of benefits from labor shortages during the war. And then after the war, there will be a bunch of strikes, in 1919, 1920, 21. The most important maybe being the Great Steel Strike of 1919. Important industries, there was also strikes after the war, right? And so the labor movement is growing. It's becoming more radical. The progressive movement, capital P progressive, is growing. That's not a single organization movement, but basically like in the movement in the direction of social democracy, you could say, where there's a dramatic expansion of government support for citizens, for workers, to rein in basically corporate excess. And the Socialist Party of America, led by most famously Eugene Debs, who came out of the labor movement, is also growing in this time. In that era, hundreds of cities in the United States had socialists on their city councils, in some cases mayors, right? There was a socialist elected to the Congress from Wisconsin, right? And so the 19-teens, especially the second half, which is the World War I era, was a time of tremendous fervor. And this is global, right? The Mexican Revolution is going on, right? Next door, the Irish Revolution, right, is sort of attempted during the war, 1916, but there's sort of Irish republicanism is growing. Of course, the Soviets revolution will occur, a two-part revolution in 1917 that will sort of change the world in many ways, right? And then after the war, there's attempted communist revolutions in Germany and Hungary. And so it's quite the time period that the IWW is a part of, but not the only player in the United States or the world.
The IWW, the organizing that it was involved in, the workers that it was organizing at the time were heavily important to the war effort, which ends up playing a part later on. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, the truth is that the Woodrow Wilson, he's the president from 1912 to 1920, the Wilson administration is very anti-union. It's also very anti-black. Although in some ways the Wilson administration is actually better for Americans than some previous presidents, the Wilson administration really fears and loathes the IWW, right? The fact that the IWW happens to have workers in a number of important industries isn't surprising because the IWW had a lot of reach. But it scared the bejesus out of Wilson and many others. And they believed it was not coincidental, but in fact was sort of part of a conspiracy. That's the term that was often used to sort of undermine the U.S. war effort, 1917, 1918. In other words, that the IWW was really clever in trying to organize strategic industries like timber, like mining, like ag, like transport. It is true, looking from outside, that those are important industries. It is true the IWW had some influence in those industries, and it is understandable that a government that is afraid of the IWW would be even more afraid considering IWW strength in those industries.
And the IWW, of course, being extremely against the war and calling for people not to enlist and engage in the conflict.
So the IWW never took an official stand on the war. Even though before the U.S. declared war in 1917, IWW newspapers and magazines regularly criticized the war as a capitalist enterprise in which essentially German workers were killing French and English workers. And that was so stupid because German, English, and French workers have more in common than they have not in common. Nevertheless, in 1914, notoriously, the largest democratic socialist organizations in the world, which were all in European countries, especially in Germany, all voted to support their country's war efforts. In other words, they chose nation over class. And the IWW and other left organizations that weren't involved criticized that, logically so. The Socialist Party of America, in some ways less radical than the IWW, openly criticized and officially condemned the war. The IWW, at that time led by Big Bill Haywood, who came out of the miners, knowing that the IWW has a big target on its back, essentially took the easy way out and chose not to officially condemn the war, even though a great many Wobblies, probably most Wobblies, were anti-war, right? And so trying to avoid government persecution, which obviously did not succeed, right, didn't change. Right. But the IWW never stood out against the war. And I, as I've written a lot about in one of my books, you know, dock workers in Philadelphia actually did load ships that were going to France and Belgium to support the U.S. war effort. Right. And some people logically criticize that. Right. But they weren't actually breaking any IWW policy when they did so, because the IWW officially had no policy when it came to the war, but probably most individual members were anti-war for the reasons that we've discussed, sort of there should be no war but the class war.
Well, just to get back to the Red Scare, so when did it officially begin? Is there a sort of an event or something that sort of marks the beginning of this period, or when
yes.
would you say it starts?
Although the IWW had suffered persecution from various local governments, really, after the U.S. declares war, Congress creates what was called the Espionage Act. And the Espionage Act was basically criminalized dissent. It criminalized being anti-war, meaning that you couldn't speak out right, which is another way to say that you can't think anti-war thoughts, right, which people would argue was a violation of the First Amendment, but nevertheless was passed. In 1918, there was an amendment, you might say, to the Espionage Act called the Sedition Acts. So sometimes you hear reference to the Espionage and Sedition Acts of 1917, 1918. But basically, the Espionage is the first. It kicks off the Red Scare in like April or 1917 or spring 1917. And almost immediately, the U.S. Department of Justice, which has something called the Bureau of Investigation that later is spun off to become the Federal Bureau of Investigation. But at that time, it's the underneath directly DOJ, started to, spy on the IWW and start to issue subpoenas for IWW arrests, right? Then in September of 1917, the Department of Justice coordinates invasions of IWW offices in dozens of cities across the country, issues warrants for many hundreds of Wobbly's arrests. Spring, Espionage Act, summer, spying, planning, early September 1917, mass raids that basically seek to destroy the IWW. Not everyone was arrested in September of 1917. Some people weren't arrested till later. And then there was a series of mass trials, federal trials in 1918, right? And so really the number one and the first target of the Red Scare was the IWW, beginning almost immediately after the war officially begins.
So you mentioned the Espionage Act and the Sedition Act. Another thing that people often associate with the Red Scare is the Palmer Raid. So talk about that. How did that name come about? What does it mean, and what role did that have in this wider arc?
Of course. So the Palmer Raids are very much a part of the Red Scare, right? The U.S. and its allies basically defeat the Central Powers led by Germany by late 1918. There's an armistice called, and then that's in advance of the peace negotiations that happen outside of Paris and Versailles, France, right, in 1918-1919, right? Later in 1919, the United States Department of Justice, which was led by Attorney General Palmer, initiates a further escalation of the Red Scare. Now, the IWW has already pretty much had its entire leadership across the country arrested, many of them found guilty in trials in 1918, right? And the IWW still exists, but it's radically weakened. The Palmer Raids are the escalation, because now that it's basically, in its estimation, destroyed the IWW, there are other organizations and individuals to attack. And those are generally groups associated with the pro-Soviet. There is not yet a single Communist Party of the United States. There's a number of early parties that are basically the origins of the Communist Party of the United States. There's also a number of anarchists, organizational and individual, the most well-known being Emma Goldman in that era, right, who's a Russian Jewish immigrant, but lives in the United States in this time. So the Palmer Raids basically are a series of further raids on organizations and arrests of individuals to sort of basically attack the wider left. So now that the IWW has been neutered, right, the federal government, Department of Justice, will go after the rest. This is also in the context, again, of a huge wave of strikes in 1919, more important than any other single year of strikes in the country, that began in early 1919 with the Seattle General Strike, right, included telephone operators who were predominantly women going on strike. And at that time, you actually had to ask an operator to connect a call. So basically shutting down the phone network, right? In that era, the Boston police, in the sort of notorious, but nevertheless important, first time a police went on strike, right? In Boston, Mass, right? Coal miners go on strike, hundreds of thousands, steel workers go on strike, across the Midwest. And that's in some ways really important too. And that was led by William Z. Foster, someone who had been a Wobbly, but then will become an important communist leader. And the Foster's steel strike organizing has often been cited by people in recent years, including the Amazon labor union organizers. And so the Red Scare will go after all these different unions, organizations, and parties that are seen as anti-capitalist, and therefore perceived as anti-American.
You know, one of the things that also marks this period, you know, reading about it, it also, to me, mirrors COINTELPRO. I'm thinking about, like, police and FBI attacks on the Black Panther Party. And also today with, you know, the murder and assassination of Tortuguita in the Atlanta Forest, you know, who was also a member of the IWW. Is this marshalling of all levels of law enforcement? You have like these massive raids that are coming down from the top, but also then you have just like local police and even, you know, just local thugs that kind of get brought into the repression. Can you just talk about that? Just kind of like the layers of this repressive apparatus that were aimed at the left?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to connect those dots. Of course, I'm a historian, so I'm always sort of saying that the past shapes the present, and that's why we should care about the past. So like really the 19th century, for all the horrible things that happened, slavery, the sort of mass displacement and killing of Native Americans and other things, wasn't a sort of a police operation, right? It's really in the 20th century. And so if we're thinking about how the state in its multiple layers, although I'm often thinking about the federal government, right, is sort of using its power, its police power to investigate, spy on, infiltrate and destroy and discredit, right? That's a 20th century phenomena, right? COINTELPRO is a great example of that, created in the 50s and lasting until, well, we don't know if it ended, but we believe sometime in the mid 70s when the FBI had this basically secret op, right, to sort of basically infiltrate, spy on, undermine and destroy, right? Like, I mean, not simply gather information, but actively work to destroy, most notoriously, like you said, the Black Panther Party, but also even sort of more mainstream civil rights activists like Martin Luther King and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, right? Like, all that was sort of built on originally the second Red Scare, right? And so remembering that J. Edgar Hoover is the through line, he's actually involved in the Parma raids. He's the head of the Bureau of Investigation before it becomes independent of the Department of Justice. He's the one who creates COINTELPRO and leads it until his death in 1972, right? Like, and so we don't want to put it on just one man, but actually this person has 50 years of power, perhaps more powerful than any other government official, right? And the government's, I mean, he has two things in mind, especially. Of course, he hates lots of people, but really sort of the left and African-Americans, yeah, and other people of color. And so that the Black Panther Party is a target is not surprising because it was both anti-capitalist as well as sort of black nationalist, right? But that builds on what was happening in the first Red Scare, where they really went after the left. And of course, the IWW, well, in the union I studied in Philadelphia was, I say, the most powerful interracial union in the country before the 1930s, right? And then in the 1950s and 60s, COINTELPRO sort of ramps that up and goes after more groups, including anti-Vietnam organizations, right? It won't be until later that the federal government, using similar sort of powers, we'll sort of start to investigate the radical environmental movement. And we can take that up to the Cop City stuff with its sort of environmental components, but also, like you said, the fact that, you know, the martyr was himself a wobbly. And so we can draw a sort of a line, even though there's sort of breaks in these lines. The actions of the federal government sort of, they have the same playbook. Right. They develop it in the World War One era during the first Red Scare, and they continue to use it to this day.
So let's step back and kind of look at the wider picture a little bit here. How did the state drum up anti-radical and anti-immigrant hysteria in order to further push these goals? Because I think a lot of people listening to this are just thinking, wow, I mean, this is a, you know, a massive operation. I mean, we're talking literally thousands of people rounded up in these raids, thousands of people deported. I mean, people like Emma Goldman were certainly, you know, high profile figures. I mean, they're getting deported from the country. We have labor leaders. I mean, this is a big deal. So how did they sort of justify this in the eyes of the public?
Yeah, of course. Well, I mean, there's multiple different threads that are connected in a lot of ways. So like, remember that the late 1800s and the early 1900s, really from the Civil War to World War One, was the largest wave of immigration in U.S. history and world history up until that time. Approximately 30 million people move to the United States, mostly from Europe, from, say, 1865 to 1915. And there's a lot of so-called native-born Americans, people who are generally of sort of Anglo or German or Northern and Western European background, generally Protestants, are very unhappy with the growing immigration to America that's diversifying America significantly, albeit now it's often seen as they're all white folks. That's a false sort of equivalent because in that era, race was in some ways less significant than ethnicity and nationalism, right? Not every European immigrant was seen as white and not every European immigrant identified as white. They wouldn't have known what that was, right? It's a new concept to them, right? And so when my grandma, great grandma moves from what's now Ukraine, a Jewish woman, to New York City in 1905, she doesn't know what white means, right? Like, yeah, but she's Jewish, right? And a lot of the majority of white Americans or European Americans in that era didn't like Jews, didn't like Catholics, didn't like Orthodox Christians, right? Didn't like Southern Europeans, right? And so it's actually very easy to drum up anti-immigrant hysteria. It exists in the mainstream culture, especially among rural Americans. And at that time, the majority of Americans are still living in rural and small towns. The majority of people who are born in the U.S. and the majority of people who are Protestant, right? Like, the Ku Klux Klan will be reborn in 1915. And when it's reborn after succeeding in its first objective in the 1870s and 80s of sort of destroying black equality, right, in the South, it's a national organization with millions of members, including millions outside of the South, including maybe the governor of Indiana and the state legislature in Oregon, right? Like, and so, you know, the Wobblies are anti-xenophobic, right? The left is generally better on issues of immigration, right? And so it's easy, actually, to sort of say, oh, these are foreign ideas. There are foreign people. It's true that actually some of these ideas are supported by immigrant communities, especially early communism is really strongest among immigrant communities in eastern, northeastern cities. The IWW, however, actually is very much a so-called American organization, despite its internationalist idea. You can't actually xenophobic destroy the IWW. Most of its members were born in the U.S. And so, but those two things feed on each other, right? Like, and also, you know, anti-capitalists and radical unionists, of course, you don't need to sort of need the federal government to scare the middle and upper classes about that, because they're seeing threats to their wealth and power, right? Like, and so the federal government is able to coordinate very nicely, especially with corporations and employer organizations. You might be thinking of the Chamber of Commerce, which you can, but you also could be thinking about something like the National Association of Manufacturers, not a household name, but actually an important sort of multi-industry trade organization that's predominantly about being anti-union. Right. And so basically the open shop, which was slang for anti-union, sort of dovetails very nicely with what was called Americanism or 100% Americanism, which is xenophobia. Right. And combine that with war. Right. Because during wartime, you're either with us or against us. Right. And so war is always when governments repress dissent, because they need unity, right? And there's always some people among the ordinary people who buy into that, right? That you're with us or against us, love it or leave it, wave the flag, right? And so using nationalism sort of, or patriotism as we use in America, sort of an equivalent term. So those are effectively used by the federal government, A, to drum up support for the war, but B, to drum up support for, to destroy the enemies of the state from within. Right. And we could be talking about the U.S. Civil War, by the way. Lincoln really sort of suppressed dissent inside the Union during the Civil War. You can make an argument that that wasn't so unwise, but nevertheless, it happened. Right. World War One was really notorious for mass violations of civil liberties. I mean, the worst of it, of course, was of Eugene Debs, or the most well-known, right, for a speech he gave in Ohio in 1918 during the war, when he basically said that working people are going to die to sort of basically fill the pockets of the rich. He's sentenced to 10 years in prison, right, federal prison, for the crime of speech, right? A great many Americans believed what Debs said, but nevertheless, Debs was punished for that, you know, alleged violation of the Espionage Act, right? And so the state is doing this. This is also obviously not unique to the United States of America. Generally speaking, when countries are at war, the government tries to crack down on disagreement and dissent, and sometimes uses its police powers to attack, right, citizens or others who are critical of the government's stance on war.
You know, one thing you mentioned that I find really interesting, I want to go back to a little bit. You mentioned Ku Klux Klan and sort of its, I believe that would be its like second iteration during this Red Scare time. And I feel like a lot of us have seen that famous IWW poster against the Klan. Can you talk a little bit about that history? I know that there was like gun battles and stuff. Does this also take place during the same period, or is this a different time?
So yeah, it is in sort of approximately the same time. So the IWW is often attacked by police forces, but it's also sometimes attacked by vigilantes and non-governmental organizations, sort of some of the famous examples are like the Everett Massacre outside of Seattle in 1916, but then even more so the 1919 Centralia Massacre, also in Washington State, where basically Wobblies were attacked by the American Legion, which is this brand new organization that's an organization of so-called patriots who are veterans of World War One, right? Like, you know, and so it's the American Legion could be considered as sort of a right-wing nationalistic organization of military veterans, right? The Ku Klux Klan,
which sort of like if the Proud Boys had actually gone to war, as
exactly, but also multiply those numbers by 500,000, right? Like,
wow.
Like, I mean, the Proud Boys and are sort of losers, but like they're small in number, right? But the American Legion grew very quickly to be a large organization and still exists. I should also note that it was segregated, right? And like, and so there was, they often didn't let black veterans in, or they put them into all black American Legion segregated units. So a town might have a white and a black American Legion, right? And so like, you know, the American Legion is going, the Klan though, does have multiple million members around the country, right? And will be powerful for really from 1915 to into the late 20s, we might say, as sort of one phase of their history, right? And the IWW was often sort of attacked by Klan, but also other vigilante groups, often in cahoots with employers, right? So the most notorious example, right, of sort of vigilantes unknown to this day, murdering a Wobbly, is Frank Little, which maybe we could talk about. But in the 20s, the IWW will sort of be attacked by the KKK in, say, sort of timber areas, like in forested areas or in mill towns in Maine and maybe other parts of the country. And yeah, that sort of poster created by an unknown Wobbly at an unknown time, but almost certainly in the early 1920s, right, where the IWW has distinguished itself from the Klan because the Klan is anti-Jewish, anti-Catholic, anti-labor, anti-black, whereas the IWW is inclusive, but also sort of anti-capitalist, right? Like, there's not like many examples of those sorts of direct conflicts, but like those two organizations, one on the rise numerically, one sort of basically squashed by federal power, but then receives a lot of support, right, from these right-wing vigilante groups, the Klan being the most well-known.
Who watches the watchmen up on the block? It's not these politicians hiding behind the cops. It's not the fake activists, snitches, and ops. When the snatch vans pull up, who gets got? Riot gear goons toting chemical weapons. Target makeshift shields and some pink umbrellas. Bella Chow in the air like the capsicum spray. Gets spicy every night.
Mayor Dirk and Paige Hymel sent on informant missions. Phoenix Jones fights against the people's resistance. Fight back, Jack and white supremacists for riches. Welcome to C-Town, the anarchist jurisdiction. Listen, tear gas flooded streets persisted. I'm breaking down the barricades and de-arrested. Missing with the charges, but the state persisted. BKs and presidents escapade acquitted. No Biden to those slave trade bastards. Admitted eight cash beating so much faster.
Take it to the streets and fuck the police. No justice, no peace.
Stay fighting, Mayday 5, I'm the one that master. What's written, prosecutors and hogs without the pasture.
Who watches the watchmen up on the block?
Black block on the block, fuck the cops.
Been on the ground steady for Black Lives Matter. Inhale so much tear gas, I'll probably catch cancer. By the time I turn 40, riot cops in Portland, man, will beat you in the street and report that you assaulted them. That's what they tried to say when I got kidnapped by the feds in 2020, didn't stop, I went back. Mayor is a clown, the government's a circus. Can't reform the system, let's feed it to a furnace. I'm rolling with the anarchists and radicals. Ironic, we fighting pigs who treating us like animals. You the type to speak defense, I'm the type to de-arrest. Me and you are not the same, fuck you white supremacists. Number one demand was defund the police. But all around the country, their budgets increase. Don't be surprised if the riots don't stop, nigga.
Black block on your block, fuck the cops.
I don't see shit, I don't know shit. I don't see shit, I don't know shit. Fight this one, but we won't flip. Rather turn and die than run my lip. You don't see shit, you don't say shit. You don't see shit, you don't say shit. In Northwest, this don't be the depiction.
Anarchist jurisdiction.
All these feckless liberals go on in pearl clutch. Manny Ellis dead and they worried about a Starbucks. Cops murder, but the protest is when politicians fearmonger about the lawlessness. What ass rich coming from the rich, where they get their money from?
I don't see shit, I don't know shit.
When they ride a whole world, it's called business. When they ride a whole world, it's called business. In this anarchist jurisdiction, the cops circle around a block, beating down anybody they want, law and order, keep it calm and compliant. When you fight back, they call it a riot, What's a peaceful protest but a parade to quiet you? What's a state but a monopoly on violence? Built on slavery, genocide, and bullets. God bless America, you know we all love it.
Take it to the streets and fuck the police. No justice, no peace.
This use of the Espionage Act, and again, this is happening in the backdrop of World War One, and it's just fascinating, this idea that employers or the state would attempt to argue that the IWW essentially was this German asset, essentially, which, I mean, again, there's so many parallels today. I mean, I don't know if you saw this, but there were people protesting outside of Nancy Pelosi's office over her support of the State of Israel, who's, you know, conducting an ongoing ethnic cleansing campaign against Palestinians. And she accused those people of being essentially Chinese agents or Russian agents and something like that. So, I mean, again, there's all these parallels.
Yeah, so, like, I mean, xenophobia is bad, period, but it's also weaponized, right, like during sort of convenient times. And so even though millions of Americans were German immigrants, were German Americans, the descendants of German immigrants, right, like because the United States was fighting against Germany in World War One in 1917, 1918, right, German Americans were often sort of persecuted, right, including sort of like some sort of wacky, crazy things. That's like when many German Americans changed their last names, when many people who might have spoken German stopped speaking, when many public schools stopped teaching German, where some people start calling it sauerkraut, but instead would call it freedom cabbage, right? I mean, the parallels to the 21st century with Iraq, yes, of course, also comes to mind, right? And so the IWW, for being not pro-war, was automatically then sort of associated with and sort of then intentionally sort of connected to the IWW. And so there's political cartoons that are anti-IWW that suggest that they're basically pro-German or taking money from Germany. That's all false, right? It's just another way to justify, right, sort of the IWW persecution is that they are pro-German. Now, if I can say, as far as sabotage goes, sabotage is one of these sort of tricky things where it's this concept that comes from Europe. Maybe Big Bill Haywood brought the concept actually to the IWW around 1910 after visiting France and learning from how the French workers sometimes would cut power lines and cable lines to sort of disrupt communications, right, during strikes. The IWW rhetorically embraced the concept of sabotage, very publicly and loudly, and all you can find lots of sort of examples of that in their publications from the era. They often meant it as destruction of property or even just slowing down at work, what may also be called working to rule or other things, in order to basically hit the employer where they hurt the most, which is the pocketbook. Unfortunately for the IWW, all of these uses of the term sabotage and publications and imagery of sabotage are very convenient once the Espionage Act exists, because then and even state governments use this to say, well, the IWW supports destruction of property, right? Like, and all we have to do is look at their publications, right? Like, even though there's almost zero examples of IWW actions to destroy property to support the concept of sabotage, they have made it easy through their publications and statements to use that once the Espionage and Sedition Acts are created during World War One. And just sort of important note, the Espionage Act is still on the books, right? And so you might be thinking this is ancient history, but in fact, this law that was created to support this war in 1917 is still used by the U.S. government to sort of go after enemies of the state. Although I should also note some of those enemies of the state are actually enemies of the state. So the Espionage Act also has been sometimes invoked to go after people who supported the January 6th insurrection in 2021, right? And so I would actually say that's not necessarily a bad use of the law. You know, this law still exists.
Yeah, and I mean, the specter of the IWW continues. I mean, we just had a podcast looking back on the J20 trials, and the state tried during those trials in you know, right after the inauguration of Trump in 2017 to argue that even membership in the IWW was essentially admitting you were part of some criminal conspiracy. In the ongoing saga of people facing domestic terrorism and RICO charges in Atlanta, they've also made the they've mentioned the IWW. They've actually referred to it as the not the industrial workers of the world, the international workers of the world. But they've mentioned that, or they've tried to basically paint this picture of the IWW being this epicenter of anarchy and chaos and property destruction, which again makes you wonder, like, are they reading back on their own history and looking back on what, you know, the state has previously done? And again, you know, these parallels in history. But just going forward, you know, we talked about the Espionage Act, all these sort of laws. Another one that comes up is the criminal syndicalism laws. Syndicalism, of course, being, you know, most people will think of anarcho-syndicalism. Syndicalism meaning essentially just unionism, so criminal unionism laws. How were these used to attack and try to break the IWW?
Yeah, they were very important is the short version. So it is a little confusing for Americans because we don't use that word syndicalism very much, but some of us who know some other languages might recognize that term because it's in many Latin languages, right, sort of a term that's synonymous with unionism, right, syndicalism. And if you put that anarcho in front, right, like, and so the IWW is sometimes referred to as anarcho-syndicalist because it was anti-statist. Many members were anarchists, but also it was just sort of influenced by suspicion of the state as opposed to many unions that often sort of depend upon laws in order to get rights to bargain, et cetera, right? Like, and so syndicalism, criminal syndicalism, it becomes against the law to be a member of the industrial workers of the world. This is decades before it will become against the law for a while to become a member of the Communist Party, which will happen in the 1940s and 50s, although later the Supreme Court will toss that out. And so basically, the federal government has the Espionage Act. That's 1917, before the Espionage Act, but also concurrent with the Espionage Act. A number of states, almost all out in the West, pass state laws that basically criminalize becoming a member of a syndicalist organization, which is very clearly an attack on the one organization in the country that could be called syndicalist, which is the IWW, right? And so all you had to do to violate, say, the law in Idaho or another Western state is to be a member, right? So if you're a member of the IWW, by definition, you have violated this state law. And thousands of members of the IWW were arrested or detained on charges of criminal syndicalism. Some of those people were released, but thousands were sort of went to trial, and many hundreds, perhaps thousands, were imprisoned. These were generally used against sort of ordinary or rank and file wobblies, right? Because actually, the Espionage Act, the federal sort of trials during and after World War I, essentially took out the top 200 plus leaders of the IWW for years, right? Even if they were later had their sentences commuted or pardoned or even found innocent, although that didn't really happen, right? The entire leadership, right, across the country at the national and local levels was wiped, right? To great negative consequence, right? The criminal syndicalist laws then go after everybody else, right? And I believe 20 states had laws on the books that were largely identical. It essentially outlawed the IWW membership in it. And in addition to the federal raids that you might just call the first Red Scare, although you might put the criminal syndicalists into that too, right, were very effective at weakening the IWW, say in Washington State, in California, in Oregon, in Montana, in Idaho, in Arizona, right, these states where they had actually significant reach into the mining industry, the timber industry, and the logging industry, and transportation industries, right? Like shipping, ag, timber, mining. Again, like where the big industries of the West, criminal syndicalists do a very good job of undermining IWW outfits across the West.
Okay, so let's talk about sort of the response to this. So, how did the movement respond? So, I mean, people are getting rounded up. you know, there's, you said there's kind of waves of this. First, they go after sort of key organizers and people perceived as leaders. Then they go after the rank and file. You know, obviously people like Emma Goldman are also rounded up. So, I mean, how did the left in general and just people respond to this? We've all seen images of people demonstrating, for instance, in support of the Haymarket Martyrs or people like Sacco or Vanzetti. So, I mean, we know that there are sizable movements that supported political prisoners and people facing repression. What did that look like, if anything, at that time when this was going on?
Yeah, so the IWW is really hated by a whole lot of non-working class people, even though the majority of people are working class, right? Like, and so, who stands up for the IWW? The truth is very few, right, non-radicals. The AFL unions actually very much support the efforts because they pick up the pieces. So famously in Philadelphia, not famously, but famously in my mind, right, like the local aid of the IWW dock workers will be sort of wiped out by late 1922. A few years later, the AFL's longshore union, the International Longshoremen Association, will reorganize the Port of Philadelphia, right? And so the AFL is laughing and happily so, led at that time by Sam Gompers, right, the longtime president of AFL. Among middle and upper class people, like I said, there's very little sympathy or support, whether they're because they're xenophobic or racist or anti-communist or pro-war. It is well worth noting, however, that one of the best known civil liberties organizations is born in this era, partially to defend the IWW. So, like, you know, the IWW is sort of separate from the fact that a lot of its leaders are arrested and its offices raided. It has to spend a lot of money, right, and a lot of resources and a lot of effort and a lot of time and a lot of energy to defend its members, right? And so there's huge efforts that often receive support beyond the unions, right, to basically support them during their trials or sort of to help the sort of their families after arrests and imprisonment, right? Like, and this really is consuming. So that really the IWW in some ways becomes a legal defense organization, which is not its purpose, right? Which is to say that it's unable to unionize or sort of support those members, right, in unions, locals, because they're so busy, right, trying to deal with sort of their fierce repression. This is similar to other radical organizations that often have to suffer the same consequences, right? And so sometimes this is called lawfare, right, where you use the law as a weapon to basically attack and undermine, right? However, there were some groups that evolve in the late teens and early 20s to defend the IWW that are not IWW members. And one of those was comes from an elite background, was a lawyer named Roger Baldwin, who helps found the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, which still exists today. Right. And although I don't always agree with the ACLU, I think I'm a current member. Right. I'd pay them money. Right. Like, because they often sort of will defend people who take unpopular stands, which is to say, stands that the majority don't hold, right? I always tell my students, I'm a teacher, right? Like, the First Amendment doesn't exist for the majority. The majority doesn't need the right to speech because you're protected by the fact that you're part of the majority. By definition, the whole reason we have something like the freedom of speech enshrined into a constitutional document is to protect the minority, right? Like, sadly, the majority often ignore that reality, right? Like, but, you know, there are some people who believe in these ideals, what you might call human rights. And so there is some efforts to defend the IWW from attacks who aren't IWW themselves. They don't have much success. But that's sort of like the best support. But the truth is that the IWW doesn't have the capacity to defend itself from state, local, and federal governments and police. Right. They are sort of overwhelmed by that. Right. Like, the union exists and persists and continues to this day, but it is drastically weakened, and it will be decades before it will be able to sort of breathe again in a way that it had before, say, 1918.
So I guess another way of putting this is, like, you know, unlike the CNT in Spain, which was able to, in the face of repression or even having to go underground, was able to sort of like organize strikes and support for itself when it faced repression. The IWW was not able to do that. Like, it wasn't able to call on the rank and file and people that supported it or were sympathetic. into the streets, like, you know, were there demonstrations and marches and rallies in support? Did that happen?
So you're correct, right? Like, there was the IWW organized lots of sort of events to sort of publicize the sort of arrests or sort of imprisonment of their leaders and members, but also to raise money. But the truth is that there's no sort of mass movement, you know, in that era. And again, sort of because of the Red Scare will spread right through the Pomerase and other things, the broader left, right, is also sort of under attack in this era. That's why the 20s are very quiet, right, when it comes to sort of radicalism or even unionism, and it won't be until the Great Depression. By contrast, in Spain, because Spain hadn't fought in World War I, really, it's the government didn't need to sort of attack its own in the same ways. It won't be until sort of the sort of fascists sort of rise up in 36 to sort of try to overthrow the government. And then the sort of the Spanish Civil War sort of emerges. And then, of course, after the fascists win by 39, the first thing they do is go after the left, including the CNT, but more broadly anti-fascist, right? And so basically what happens is the CNT lives longer because they don't suffer persecution for another 20 years, right? But there's a, that's a, some one obvious parallel, right? Because these things are not unique to the United States of America.
And you mentioned, you know, legal challenges and supporting the IWW in the courts, like the ACLU. So there was nothing was successful. I mean, nobody was able to fight this.
So correct. I mean, so the largest of the trials happened of the IWW during the war, right? And so hundreds of subpoenas were issued, ultimately almost 100 IWW leaders, including Ben Fletcher, the man who I've written a lot about, but other five other Philadelphians are sort of part of this mass trial in Chicago in federal court. It's the longest trial in the history of the country up until that time. It's widely covered, right? But the jury comes back in 30 minutes, all guilty on all counts. Everyone's sentenced to federal prison for 10 to 20 years with large fines. And you know, the IWW actually tried to mount a defense. They actually raised money. They had lawyers. They issued sort of counter testimony, et cetera. It was all ignored, right? In some other of these large trials, Wobbly's learning perhaps, or taking one lesson away, issue what they call their silent defense, where they don't even play. So they're in court, but they don't try to sort of challenge witnesses. They don't really sort of offer a vigorous defense, whatever. That doesn't work either, right? So pretty much, there are no successful legal challenges to this repression. The repression works, right? The legal system, you know, the lawyers aren't breaking the law. They're using the law that Congress has passed, right? So, like, you know, and there's no efforts. I mean, after the war, there was a belief among, say, the majority or the whatever, however that vague term might be, that there was overreach during the war. And so the sort of Sedition Act is sort of allowed to sort of sunset. Harding, who's actually a Republican president, Wilson had been a Democrat, will actually commute the sentences of a lot of these sorts of wartime imprisoned radicals, most famously Debs, who gets out of prison, I think, in what, 1922, or maybe the following year, right? Like most of the Wobblies, Leavenworth, are having their sentences commuted. They're not pardoned until FDR 10 years later, right? Which means if your sentence is commuted, you can still go back to prison if you are found guilty of some other crime, right? And so you could resume your sentence. But so there was a belief that, okay, maybe during the war, the Red Scare was a little heavy-handed, seems to violate our so-called liberal values of speech and thought in the First Amendment. So no laws were really sort of changed. The Espionage Act, like I said, continues onward. It will be used again against communists in the mid 20th century. So it's not a happy story, right? Legal repression, repression is legal. Challenges to this repression fail, right? The repression succeeds.
These examples just also highlight, you know, the need for things like, say, the Civil Liberties Defense Center. You know, we've had people from there on this show and just, or, you know, the National Lawyers Guild, and just sort of that infrastructure in place. Because, you know, if you look at sort of the things that, that the state is attempting to do or wanting to do and talking about is really go back to this, this level of repression, you know, just literally criminalizing ideologies.
Yes. I mean, the IWW ideas persist. They do help shape the sort of the next wave of labor activism in the 1930s in the birth of the CIO unions. The ILWU, famously, the West Coast Dockers, even adopt the motto of the IWW, right? The communists learn some of these lessons, and so they do have sort of communist-adjacent organizations that are labor legal organizations to sort of most famously defend even sort of black people. Like, so like in 1931, the sort of these nine young black males who are sort of quickly found guilty of sort of raping of a white woman, even though that was based on a lie, and were found guilty and were going to be executed by the state of Alabama. But it was then the International Legal Defense, ILD, that was basically a communist outfit that defended the Scottsboro Boys, as they were called, and saved them from being executed, right? Like, and so the International Legal Defense, the National Lawyers Guild, as you named, which is, I think, created also in the 30s, and then other groups do try in the 30s to defend and expand, so they create a popular front, but they also are trying to sort of widen the tent of allies, right? As fascism rises in Europe and other places, right, the sort of a popular or united front will emerge, and that includes some sort of legal social services, which are useful and wise and helpful for those who are sort of critical of the state and capitalism, right? But in the first iteration of the Red Scare, there is no equivalent to that, right? Like, and so there are maybe sort of now still in the past, but in the future of the World War One era, right? Progress is made in sort of how to figure out how to deal with the fact that persecution will come. What do we do when it comes?
You know, you mentioned the case of Frank Little, who was assassinated in 1917. Again, so many parallels with the case of Tortuguita. I know Frank Little was part Cherokee. He was a IWW organizer, was murdered by, I believe, like a collection of like vigilantes and like local police. And this is at the beginning of the Red Scare. So I just wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, this kind of like coupling of fear mongering, lawfare, but also just, you know, brutal violence. You know, one of the things we haven't really talked about, how did that play out? Just, you know, people being murdered.
So Frank Little is a legend in the IWW and maybe a little outside of it. He was an important, well-known, and highly respected IWW organizer who would organize across industries and locations. Although it's often been reported that he might have had some Native ancestry, and there's a famous, awesome Carlos Cortez print that he created in the 80s that says something similar, and I have a beautiful copy of it. Supposedly, he may not have had any Native ancestry, regardless of his ethnicity, right? He was a fierce class warrior who sort of, you know, suffered the consequences in multiple occasions, right? But most horribly, right, in Montana, like Butte, Montana, being the leading mining, copper mining town in the country, which had a very powerful copper mining union, right? And some of those people were wobblies. And so when Little is out there in 1917 to help organize among already unionized radical miners in Butte, Montana, basically in the middle of the night, a group of men grab him out of his hotel room, drag him out naked, drag him through the streets of Butte, pulling him by a rope, dragging him on the streets. So imagine like a naked body being sort of dragged through the streets where his, like, not just skinned up, but like your whole chunks of skin and your body is broken, right? And he'll ultimately be found hanging from a railroad trestle outside of town, right? And so he was just assassinated, right? Like, no one who was involved in the murder of Frank Little was ever arrested, let alone punished for that murder, right? And it was widely understood to be basically funded by and ordered by probably the copper mining companies, not necessarily the police or the government, although with the sort of acknowledgement and not opposition of government, right? And this was not unique, right? The Pinkertons are the most well-known, but there was multiple corporations that were basically national companies that were hired guns for strike breakers during strikes, but also would spy on, infiltrate, destroy unions, right? All of this was common, if horrible, right? But the killing of Frank Little in 1917, he's buried outside of Butte, Montana. I've never had the chance to go, but you can visit his grave if you wish it. I've seen lovely photographs of what people have done to remember him, right? Like, is the most notorious example of a IWW murder, right? In the first Red Scare era.
What would you say are the lasting impacts and lessons and just kind of residual traces of this on the left and in the United States in general? I mean, you mentioned sort of like some of these laws being sunset, but also that they're sort of still on the books. Is there a general feeling that, you know, this would never happen again, or is it just inevitable, just considering just the nature of this country?
Well, I mean, so my opinion is that, like, while we live in a capitalist economy in the country or the world, right, like, there will be forces that will use fear of communism, even if Wobblies aren't necessarily communists, right? But it's all the same to those who are anti, or to all the same to those who are very pro-capitalist, right? Like, so, like, you know, the lesson is, of course, is that all the weapons will be used against revolutionaries who, I mean, of course, are calling for revolution. This should not really be surprising, right? Like, I mean, it's unfortunate, right? That really it is the World War I era. The first Red Scare sets a blueprint for not just the Communist Party, but the radical labor movement, right? Because 11 unions will be purged from the CIO in 1949, right? 9 of those 11 will ultimately be destroyed in advance of a merger between AFL and CIO, right? The Red Scare is powerful. It's an effective tool, right? How do you guard against that? There's different ways to guard against it, I suppose, but first thing is to sort of be aware that it's coming, right? And so people have to be prepared, right? If you're actually attending to sort of form revolutionary organizations, the state and its allies, especially in capital, will come for you, right? Like, they will also probably use xenophobia and racism as well as other sorts of divisive ideologies to sort of give sort of substantial support to those ideas, because some people might buy into those. Some people who are haters or fear, right? The IWW and other radical organizations will, of course, learn from these things. So one thing is that how do you organize? If I had a blueprint, I wouldn't be talking to you. I'd be running some organization, I suppose. But I'm actually convinced that the CIO sort of approach proved more effective, at least in the short term, right, than the IWW, because the CIO grew from 0 to like 5 million inside of 10 years, right? Not all those union members were anti-capitalist revolutionaries. Most probably weren't, but they were in organizations that were often led by and sort of with militants in who were from the left, right? And so if the goal is actually to get the majority of people, which is us, to sort of support our causes, we need to be in those sorts of mass organizations. And so although I'm very sympathetic to the IWW and have written a lot about them, forming sort of dual or independent radical organizations instead of going to where the people are and then trying to take them with you, this is a question of organizational and tactics, right? But you can make a good argument that you should basically try to capture, you could say, sort of the sort of mainstream unions as opposed to sort of create independent new unions, right? And so in terms of the labor-specific component of class struggle, right, for those of us who are not opposed to sort of using political power as in elections, right, like, you know, you just have to be aware, right? Like, if you're voting for Democrats, you have to sort of put those Democrats' feet to the fire, because, well, we see what happens with the Israeli war, right? They're going to sort of they're going to knee jerk for support of military persecution, state power, etc., right? And so, well, like, you, I'm personally of the mind that you try to use what power you potentially have, even if it's short term and sort of, on a temporary basis, right? Like, I think that the IWW's, everyone understood that the persecution was the single largest force that undermined the IWW. It was this powerful revolutionary organization with hundreds of thousands of members and millions of people who probably supported some of its beliefs. But by the mid-20s, really had still existed, but didn't have that power anymore, right? And so other organizations will pick up the sort of maybe slack in future generations. One should draw the lessons, right? Very clear is that the state has the power to sort of go after what's deemed as threats, right? Like, so in, as you noted, in the 60s, that was often seen as radical black organizations. But the earlier, that was seen as sort of, the Wobblies were sort of seen as sort of public enemy number one.
I mean, anything else you want to say about this? Anything we haven't covered? I know you also want to give a shout out for a book or two, maybe that people can read as a way to kind of investigate this more.
Of course. So, you know, this historian can be forgiven for recommending some books of history. I think my friend Ahmed White's recent book, Under the Iron Heel, The Wobblies and the Capitalist War on Radical Workers, that came out just a year and a half ago, is really a great book that really focuses on the history of persecution of the IWW during the First Red Scare. And it's sort of a very powerful book. And the title references a famous novel by Jack London called The Iron Heel, which was a very popular novel among radicals and workers in the early 20th century, even though now it is not popular at all, right? I actually am reading it for the first time right now, and I'm enjoying it. I'm not loving it, right? But yeah, for those who want to read fiction, and we all should, right? Like the Jack London's original novel was sort of probably the most popular novel among Wobblies, right? And so that's interesting, right? I do think that a book that I helped create called Wobblies of the World, A Global History of the IWW, is an important one. It's an anthology, so it has chapters written by many different people from many different countries who know many different languages and therefore were able to read papers, newspapers, and archives from many different languages, right? Because this was, the IWW was a global organization. It understood and understands, right, that capitalism is a global phenomena. And so you will not beat capitalism in the United States alone, period, right? Like in the same way that the Soviet Union failed to defeat capitalism by trying to create communism or socialism in one country, right? And so we need to be thinking about global struggle. As hard as it is to think about nationwide struggle, we actually need to be bigger than that, right? Because like the next time there's going to be sort of revolutionary organizations, they should be internationalist, right? Not just supporting struggles in other countries, but actually networked as part of, right? And so the genius of the IWW from its birth, right, in 1905 was that it understood that, right? Like that it was actually, some people suggested it should be called the Industrial Workers of America, but others rejected that and the majority voted to support the name Industrial Workers of the World, right? And so I actually think that book Wobblies of the World, which was published by Pluto Press in 2018, is it's also nice because the chapters are short. You can just drop in and you can read a chapter about Mexico. You can read a chapter about New Zealand. You can read a chapter about Ireland, right? And so I'm very proud of that book that I helped create. You know, I do think the IWW store at online actually is a great clearinghouse, as well as really the bookstore of the working class history is also has, I think, a relatively good bookstore, right, for those of us who sort of want to read. I do also want to mention, actually, that right now, although there is a podcast that's about the CIO era called Organizing the Unorganized. That's like, I don't know, an 8 or 9 part thing. And so for those of us who believe that unions and the IWW was first and foremost a union, it wasn't just anti-capitalist, right? If the syndicalists believe that the work, people have their greatest power on the job. And so if you actually want to achieve revolution, you will achieve it through working class power, not through political or electoral power, right? Then you, you know, you might want to be thinking about those things. And so you might want to be learning about sort of where have we seen successful union drives. I appreciate that we're in an upsurge of union support that hasn't translated into an increase in union membership, even though there have been more strikes and there's a lot more support for unions, and that's necessary, but it's not sufficient, right? And so in my opinion, the goal should be figuring out how we get more people into unions. Unions were and are still the largest organizations of working people, right? And working people have more power together Rich people have money, right? Like, and so anything we can do to think about how to empower and expand unions in the U.S. and worldwide, if you want to try to end the war in Israel, the labor movement is currently sort of the most loud and important voice, in my opinion, in criticizing the war and calling for a ceasefire, right? Like, and I think those are the ways that we need to be thinking. And that's something we can all do in our own neighborhoods and communities, is support and join and organize unions, right? And then you make them more radical, right? That's sort of my 8 cents.